he warned the governors not to fall into traps set by the opposition. "Don't fall into the argument that there is no one to replace Saddam Hussein," said Bush. "And our planning will make sure there is no oil disruption. We are looking at all options to enhance oil flow. Military force is my last option, but it may be the only choice," Bush stated. "I'm going to make a prediction. Write this down. Afghanistan and Iraq will lead that part of the world to democracy. They are going to be the catalyst to change the Middle East and the world." One of the first questions from the governors was about recent comments by the German justice minister comparing Bush to Hitler. Germany was days away from national elections, and despite giving his word to the president previously that he would not stand in the way of Bush's plans or do anything to undermine them, German Chancellor Schroeder, along with his cabinet, had made speaking out publicly in opposition to the war in Iraq a central part of their party's strategy for winning. "I won't put up with that crap," Bush replied tersely, being compared to Hitler. There was nothing that angered the president more than a world leader who violated private assurances he made, and I would later hear Bush say as much to a number of world leaders in private, sometimes using Schroeder as an example. If Bush gave his word to a foreign leader, that leader could take it to the bank, and Bush expected the same in return. When asked about building public support for war, Bush said, "There is a case to be made, and I have to make it. Iraq is a threat we will deal with in a logical way. If we have to act, my choices are really three. One, someone kills him, Saddam Hussein. Two, the Iraqi population rises up and overthrows him. Three, military action." One governor asked Bush about the timing for military action. "If we are going to go in militarily, it will be as soon as possible. It may take a while to resolve at the UN. This is a dangerous time for us on the political front. I worry that time will dissipate the UN speech," he added, stressing the need to press ahead urgently so as not to lose any momentum. He also noted that the mission would be to topple Saddam and change the regime, stating that his two sons and top generals would be removed as well. A few minutes later, Bush said, "If Saddam Hussein gets his hands on nuclear weapons, it will change the world. If he does it during my term, I will have failed. There is nothing more risky than letting Saddam Hussein develop weapons of mass destruction," Bush commented in response to another question. "We will deal with him. This is not about inspections. It is about weapons of mass destruction and disarming the regime of them. The inspections are a means to an end. He is an evil man. I have seen a video of Saddam Hussein himself pulling the trigger on a man who didn't like his policies. He killed his two son-in-laws." The president concluded the meeting by stating that it is a tough decision to commit troops. "I assure you, though, if we have to go into Iraq, we will be tough and swift, and it will be violent, so troops can move very quickly. During the Gulf War, it took 10 sorties to destroy two targets. Now we can fly one sortie to destroy two targets. If we go, we will use the full force and might of the United States military. Now, if it looks like he is losing his grip on power, I am confident he will be gone. International pressure could help get it done. You see, I believe in the power of freedom." He also stressed that it was important for a leader to speak clearly and to be tough, credible, strong, and forceful. Then he expressed his belief that freedom is a universal principle. "We believe everybody matters, not just Americans." Later at the press stakeout outside the main entrance to the West Wing, Governor John Rowland of Connecticut, then chairman of the Republican Governors Association, called the meeting a heart-to-heart on Iraq. But it was also a frank strategy powwow between the leader of a campaign and some important members of his team, a collection of local politicians who could play a crucial role in helping to generate popular support for the decision to invade. In early October, Bush delivered a major speech outlining the threat in Cincinnati, Ohio. Later in October, Congress overwhelmingly and in strong bipartisan fashion passed a joint resolution authorizing the use of military force in Iraq. This strong congressional backing strengthened our public case and convinced many Americans of the necessity of using force against Iraq. If members of Congress supported the president so strongly, he must be on the right course. In mid-November 2002, just before the start of the debate on a new Iraq resolution at the United Nations, My predecessor, R.A. Flesher, got married and went on his honeymoon. I assumed his responsibilities while he was away. 2 days later, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 1441, stating that it was a final opportunity for Saddam Hussein to come clean fully and unconditionally or face serious consequences. For 12 days, I would be on the front lines of the political propaganda campaign in the march to war, conducting press briefings, attending presidential meetings, and sitting in on some top-level discussions. The White House Iraq Group, WIG, had been set up in the summer of 2002 to coordinate the marketing of the war to the public. It would continue as a strategic communications group after the invasion had toppled Saddam's regime, and I would participate in it once I became White House Press Secretary. As Deputy Press Secretary, I filled in a couple of times for my predecessor when he could not attend, including during that period in November. Some critics have suggested that sinister plans were discussed at the WIG meetings to deliberately mislead the public. Not so. There were plenty of discussions about how to set the agenda and influence the narrative, but there is no conspiracy to intentionally deceive. Instead, there were straightforward discussions of communications strategies and messaging grounded in the familiar tactics of the permanent campaign. At the meeting I attended in November, shortly after passage of the new UN resolution, the discussion centered on one of the key messages we wanted to get across at the time, the need for a zero-tolerance policy toward the Iraqi regime, accepting no evasion or deceptions by Saddam Hussein. The UN resolution had called for full and unconditional cooperation and compliance, and I would emphasize that message from the podium. It was a message the president had also emphasized during a meeting with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan I attended at the time. Though I sensed we were on the verge of war, I didn't fully appreciate how clearly yet subtly our messages demonstrated that Bush had been set on regime change from the earliest days of his decision to confront Iraq. The UN speech he gave in September had been an ultimatum. Either the UN acts to disarm Saddam Hussein or the United States will. The zero-tolerance message was a further sign of how determined the president was to topple the regime by force. Saddam was never going to come completely clean. His power was grounded in his brutality and his ability to portray the regime as stronger than it was to intimidate the populace and potential enemies like Iran. The zero-tolerance policy and the new last-chance resolution gave Bush plenty of room to maneuver and plausible justification for his policy of regime change. Of course, Saddam Hussein made it relatively easy for the Bush administration to argue that it had no choice but to invade. Although UN weapons inspectors were allowed into Iraq, their access to key sites was impeded, the records they were given were incomplete and inaccurate, and the inspectors themselves stated that under the circumstances, it would take months for them to determine whether or not Saddam had complied with UN resolutions. Most people observing the situation soon concluded, Saddam is playing his old tricks. He obviously has something to hide. He was given a final chance. It was time to act. And so we acted. President Bush managed the crisis in a way that almost guaranteed that the use of force would become the only feasible option. He did this, backing it with the ultimatum in his UN speech of September and by ordering a massive buildup of American arms and military forces in the region, which for logistical reasons couldn't remain in the area indefinitely without being used. It's ironic. One of the most important rules that any press secretary must follow is never tie the president's hands unnecessarily. That is, never make any statement that restricts the president's freedom to change course or select a particular option in the future. But during the buildup to war, the president's advisors allowed his own hands to be tied, putting Bush in a position where avoiding conflict was more difficult than launching it. By creating this enormous momentum for war, the president and his advisors achieved several things. He made the job of his political opponents extraordinarily difficult, putting those who opposed the war in the position of arguing against what was almost a fait accompli. He trapped Saddam Hussein in a shrinking box, making it less and less acceptable for the dictator to continue to temporize and play games with the inspectors. He forced other countries, including those like Russia and France that had sometimes sided with Iraq, to make hard decisions as to whether or not they would permit a U.S.-led invasion absent a clear, imminent threat. Most important, the White House forestalled any debate about the fundamental goals and long-term plans for such an invasion. By pushing so hard on the WMD issue, reducing the larger issue of the future of the Middle East into a short-term emergency threat that must be dealt with now, the president and his advisors avoided having to discuss the big issues of what would happen after the invasion. Who would rule Iraq? How would the region respond? How long would the United States have to remain on the ground? How would tensions among the nation's ethnic and religious groups be resolved?